Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton, and the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out.
As far as surfing is concerned, I'd never thought of that. That's an entirely novel question for me. And I think probably the legacy will go something like this. Hey, you know, guys, Doc Pasquin's passed away. Oh, really? You know, he was a nice guy. I think that's about it.
Doc Paskowitz was a nice guy, and he was a complicated guy. He traveled the world in search of health, happiness, and the perfect wave. With his 9 children in tow, he died last week at the age of 93. We'll talk about the surf legend later on. But first, the Keystone XL pipeline is back in the news. Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu is in a tight runoff race in her home state of Louisiana, and she's pushing hard to get a bill supporting the pipeline passed in the Senate. She feels it would boost her campaign. A similar bill has already passed in the House, and that bill was sponsored by her opponent, Republican Congressman Bill Cassidy. The Senate is expected to vote on Landrieu's bill later tonight. Joining me now is Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank, longtime Washington watcher. Hi, Dana.
Hello.
Well, last we heard, she had 59 of her Senate colleagues on board, and so she needs that last 60th vote to break a filibuster and pass it. How's it looking?
Well, and those counts are kind of imprecise because a lot of people are being squirrely right now. You've got a lot of lame ducks who are don't have any particular incentive to play ball, and you've got people who just want to be wooed and see what they might get in return from either side. It's going to be close either way. But the larger point is, even if they get their 60 votes to break the filibuster and pass the Keystone Pipeline, well, the president hasn't explicitly said he's going to veto it, but he's come pretty darn close to saying that. So it's probably an exercise that will just result in nothing unless Republican leaders decide to sit down with the president and give him something in exchange for that, because that's basically how this has always looked, that he'd have to get some sort of concession to give them this pipeline they want.
And what would he want in return?
Well, some part of his energy agenda, whether that's on climate change or energy efficiency and renewables or anything else. He's got a rather long list,
yeah.
as we've heard, you know, with minimum wage and other things to help, working Americans. So there are plenty of things they could do in exchange. But, you know, I think the vetting is that nobody seems to be in the mood right at the moment to strike a deal.
So how much of this vote is a way to let Mary Landrieu keep her job? Because, Harry Reid had said he didn't want to bring this up for a vote, but now he is.
Right. I mean, I don't think they're making any secret of the fact. I've called this the Mary Landrieu Preservation Act of 2014. She said herself that she's campaigning for it here, and she's campaigning for it down in Louisiana, where she's got a runoff going on. That's why the House jumped on this so quickly, because her opponent, Congressman Cassidy, has his name on the bill over there. But you got to step back and look at what happened in the election last month. There's a runoff because no candidate got more than 50% of the vote. But if you add up all the Republicans in the race, she's going to have a very difficult time beating Cassidy, whether they build this pipeline or not. So, a lot of my colleagues on Capitol Hill are saying this is redefines the Hail Mary.
And you actually braved the rain and visited some environmental groups protesting outside her Washington home. Tell us about that. What was the scene like?
I did. Well, it was soggy and muddy, but she's got quite a nice home up there on Capitol Hill. I'm a little envious. But, You know, it struck me as interesting that here they are, you know, trying to embarrass her, show the world that she lives in this mansion, basically, and that she's defied the Democrats on oil and gas issues. And I asked several of them, so would you rather have Bill Cassidy, who has said he's not even sure he believes in climate change, would they rather have him in the Senate instead of her? And several of them said, yeah, they would. They'd rather have a more pure, smaller minority in the Senate, but a more pure one that's right on the issues. And that is almost exactly what Jim DeMint used to say, you know, about the Tea Party. He said, give me a, I don't care about the majority, I just want a small number of true-believing conservatives. And unfortunately, I think that may be the lesson some Democrats are taking away from this this election. They just need to be more pure in their ideology, because that just means we're just going to have continued fighting. And in fact, it can get worse if we have now have Democratic lawmakers afraid of primary challenges if they don't toe the line on certain issues.
Well, so how much of this vote then is really about other things, about, you know, environmentalism, about global warming, about where you stand on these issues versus the actual realities of whether this will be environmentally dangerous, or on the other side, whether it will, in fact, create jobs? I mean, apparently after 2 years after the pipeline is built, only 50 or so permanent jobs would remain on the Republican side. And on the
right.
environmental side, it's not clear that this would be as environmentally destructive as some
right.
other things that are happening. In
right.
the
and if you listen to the debate on in the Senate floor today, they're going back with, you know, trading statistics such as those that you've just cited. A colleague of mine just wrote a piece saying, you know, in some ways, time has passed it by, and it may not even be necessary to have the pipeline. But you know, in a way, this debate has been going on for 5 years, so there's no real argument that's new under the sun here. The only difference is that there was an election, and yeah, you know, the assumption is this, whether it's a good idea or not, it's going to happen. But it's likely that it's not going to happen right now, but it'll happen next year when this president can get some sort of concession in exchange for it. But, you know, this is the United States government, and you never know what's going to happen.
Dana Milbank, columnist for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
While the fight over the Keystone XL pipeline plays out in Washington, Canadians are left pretty much twiddling their thumbs. The proposed pipeline would start in the Canadian province of Alberta, after all, and the oil would travel down the pipeline. All that oil would be Canadian oil. Well, for the Canadian view of the Keystone XL pipeline, we're joined now by Edward Greenspan. He's managing editor for Global Energy, Environment, and Commodities for Bloomberg News, based in Toronto. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Were Canadians surprised that this pipeline has become such a political issue here in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, when this all started in 2008, as the energy minister said a couple of years ago, pipelines were like watching paint dry, totally boring. And then suddenly pipelines became kind of a sexy thing in the struggle between environmentalists and oil companies. So I think it was very surprising. It was just going to be an automatic thing. We've been shipping oil to the States for decades and decades, and the United States has very much insisted on having that oil for decades and decades. So took everybody by surprise.
So how do the Canadians feel about having to rely on the U.S. in order to kickstart the production of this oil in their country?
Well, you know, obviously Canadians are no more monolithic than Californians. It's about the same number of each in a way, and so there's, you know, some Canadians who aren't happy, don't really approve of the oil sands, which is a particular place where most of the soil will come from, and which is seen as a place that's produces a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. Then there's the, you know, larger group of Canadians, I would think, who see, you know, we've always had a strong economic relationship with Canada, with the United States. It's a kind of continental market, particularly in energy. And they kind of feel, what happened here suddenly? The United States, which has always treated Canada almost as a special little brother, and Canada has had a very special relationship indeed with the United States, and suddenly that doesn't seem to count for much anymore. So there's a lot of soul searching here about the whole relationship.
Mm. Well, meanwhile, I said at the beginning that Canadians are basically just sitting around waiting for the U.S. to make up its mind, but that's not entirely true because there are alternatives being pursued in terms of transporting this oil elsewhere, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple of things have gone on. First off, you know, the Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, hasn't been one for sitting a lot. He's been, you know, very purposely in the face of President Obama. He's been very public in the United States, saying that this is a no-brainer, demanding, you know, that the decision be made at some point. So you know, that's gone on. But in the meantime, the oil industry is very inventive, and they've come up with all kinds of other ways to get oil. Some oil is coming by rail over the border, which the president doesn't have any authority over, existing rail lines. Some is being barged. Canada's looking at a pipeline that go right across the country, across six provinces, across four time zones, from Alberta to the Atlantic Ocean. And then some of that oil would then get moved by ship into the Gulf Coast for the refineries there. Others would go possibly overseas. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to move that oil. And in the process, Keystone, while still mattering to the Canadian oil industry and to Canadians, and while a big symbol about the relationship, isn't as significant to play as it was when all this began.
Right. So you mentioned the Energy East proposal. That would be a $10.7 billion pipeline, as you say, that would go through much of the country. And it would end up in New Brunswick. And is there a refinery there, or would most of it have to go then down to Texas to be refined?
Well, it's a huge pipeline. It's in length and in capacity. So there is a refinery in New Brunswick that could handle a portion of that oil. Some of the oil will be dropped along the way in refineries in Quebec and would displace imported oil into eastern Canada. But a good share, probably the majority of that oil, would go for export. Some of it would allow Canada for the first time, because all of our export oil goes to the United States, virtually all of it, about 99% of it. So for the first time, we would become an international player in oil, have more choices than just the United States, upon which Canada can't necessarily rely anymore to take all of our oil. And some of it would end up in the United States. And rather than going by pipeline, you know, through Keystone and through Cushing, Oklahoma, and onto the refineries in the Gulf Coast, it would go right across Canada, go on a ship, and then be shipped to the United States.
Environmentalists here are saying that if Keystone is not approved, then that means the oil, the crude oil, would just stay in the ground in Alberta. Is that necessarily true?
Well, you know, that is the point of great, great debate in all of this. And the State Department, in its environmental assessment, said that that's not true, that the oil would find a way to market one way or another, so that there's not an argument against keeping it in the ground in order to have a better greenhouse gas emissions record. Many environmentalists say it would get trapped. And I think many Canadian oil companies, you know, worry that it could get backed up and trapped, at the same time that they seem to be finding these inventive ways to get it to market. So I don't know, you know, history will prove which of those viewpoints is right, but it is really at the heart of the debate.
Right. And also at the heart of the debate is Stephen Harper's promise that he wants to turn Canada into an energy superpower by relying on all these untapped oil reserves. But, you know, isn't the world trying to get away from fossil fuels?
Well, the world over time is clearly trying to get away from fossil fuels. So the Canadian government's not one of the keenest countries in the world at the moment on certain protocols, the Kyoto Protocol or the Copenhagen Accords, or, you know, what will happen in Paris next year, the deal that Obama and China agreed to last week. Canada isn't trying to be at the forefront of that because we are an oil-producing country. Hardly a superpower. If we were a superpower, we wouldn't be having the problems. We would have superpowers. of some sort or another. And indeed, rather than that, we can get blocked by the state of Nebraska. I think it's the 37th largest state in the United States, and it can, you know, bottle up Canada for, you know, at least 3 years now, one way or another. So until you reach the point where renewables and other forms of energy, because the world needs energy, are going to be able to displace fossil fuels will remain in great demand. I think you're producing heavy oil there in California yourself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the world's going to need oil for a while.
Edward Greenspan, Managing Editor for Global Energy, Environment, and Commodities for Bloomberg News in Toronto. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, what do you think of the Keystone XL debate? Is it time to build the pipeline now? Should we scrap the plan altogether? What do you think of the politics surrounding it? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, remembering surfing legend Doc Paskowitz. He was 93 years old when he died. He said the secret to a good life was lots of surfing, lots of sex, and no sugar. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Living in a camper on the beach, driving up and down the coast in search of the perfect wave. Sounds like the California dream. Legendary surfer Dorian Doc Paskowitz lived that dream, and he took his family along with him. Paskowitz died last week. He was 93 years old. In the 1950s, he abandoned a successful medical practice for a life devoted to surfing. He lived with his wife and nine children on the beach in a 24-foot RV.
After years of insomnia, after years of anxiety, I embarked upon an odyssey.
Dorian Paskowitz is a 58-year-old doctor who one day decided to give it all up and spend the rest of his life traveling with his family in a tiny camper from one wave to another.
He wanted us to be unchained to a mortgage at a moment's notice, just get in and go.
We'd wake up one morning and we'd be in Pensacola. Wake up another morning, we'd be in Corpus Christi, San Francisco, Baja,
Florida,
Venezuela,
New Mexico,
Alabama,
El Paso.
We just spur of the moment, go wherever.
Open the camper door, go out and do your thing, lunch is at noon. We were not attached to the physical world at all.
That's from the 2007 documentary Surfwise about the surfing Paskowitz family. It was directed by Doug Prey, who's here now. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, I think a lot of us dream about what Doc Paskowitz did, dropping everything, living this romantic life on the beach, surfing the endless summer. But he did it, right?
It is so true. He's one of the few people that you hear in life, that you might meet in life, who actually have these a vision and a dream and actually did it. Not just for like a day or a month or a year, but for many, many years. He stayed completely focused on this idea of living healthily and raising his nine children sort of as if they were in the woods, so to speak, like in the wild, like how a pack of wolves might live. Or
but in an RV, all crammed together in that RV.
Yeah. They lived very simply, mm-hmm. and they lived a life that was filled with all the other things that he thought were far more important than society usually goes after. So he shunned formal education for the kids, and they were homeschooled, and they did teach them a lot. But that's what a lot of people first notice is like, oh, you mean the kids didn't go to school? And they didn't. But they would surf every single day, and his whole theory is health is everything.
Health is more than the mere absence of disease. It's the presence of a superior state of well-being, a pizzazz, a vitality that has to be worked for each and every day of your life. You cannot get it in a bottle or from Dr. Phil. It's got to be gotten through diet and exercise and rest and recreation and attitudes of mind working all together every day of your life. And then for young men can become supermen and old men can become older.
You know, and we're talking in the 60s, he did this with his family, and it was it was no question about it. He was ahead of his time.
He didn't entirely give up medicine, did he?
No, he turned away from the medical establishment. He went to Stanford and he had a degree and he's a doctor. And He saw doctors smoking, and he saw doctors who were overweight because they're eating wrong. And he just, it made no sense to him. He's like, why can't we be more pure? If we're doctors, we need to help people. And the way to help them is to show them how to live healthy lives. And so he's the kind of guy that, like, the first time I met him ever to do an interview, he came up to me and he pinched my belly. And I was like, you're fat, Doug Prey.
Which, by the way, I'm looking at you, you're not. So he had pretty strict definitions, huh?
Yeah, no, he's really strict about that. He was an extremist, like a lot of great thinkers. He was an extremist, and there was a price to be paid for that. And it was also, he's an amazing guy. He's very inspiring and very well known throughout the surfing world.
But some of the kids in your documentary as adults, they were a little ambivalent about their upbringing.
Well, they all, if you talk to any one of the nine kids, and I got to interview all of them, they're amazing, all of them. To a name, they all rebelled in their own way. There was some point in each of their lives where they're like, you know what, this is ridiculous. But they realized that even though what they had as children was incredibly special, and people on the outside were really jealous, it also didn't prepare them for the very society that they were shunning. And so, the movie I made really tells that story of how they kind of got out there, and a lot of them realized, wow, I actually can't even go to medical school like my dad did, or I don't know how to do contracts if I want to start a business. And so what's interesting is they, all of them have very unique skills. A number of them became really well, they're amazing musicians. I mean, they've all gone off and done very interesting and successful things, but the challenge of fitting into society has been a big one.
And have any of them continued his lifestyle, living on the beach and surfing?
From the best of my knowledge, I've been a little bit out of touch with the family the last few years, although I'm still in contact. But Adam Paskowitz really did probably most closely follow his dad's dream. And he has his family on a boat and travels the world. And just raising his – he has a son named Doc also, so He's doing the same thing.
What about the scenes – there are some uncomfortable scenes in your documentary about how – closely the family lived,
there were
nine children, so
there were nine children, and Doc is very frank about sex and sexuality, so a lot of people are just shocked that, like, they would have sex in the camper when there's other kids sleeping in there and things like that, and it just seems appalling to a lot of people, and to others who look at it more like a family living like wild animals, it's not as much.
But were the kids, looking back on it, were they okay with that?
Well, no. Not all of them, no. Some of them were very outspoken and saying it was disgusting. I didn't want that. They didn't want that at all.
And that was very, very disturbing for a kid to hear.
It was just so disgusting to have to hear your parents, you know, loud, weird copulation.
I would have a technique when my dad and mom would go at it every single night, where I would fold my inner ear, my lobe over that, and then fold this ear down, and then try to, like, get a pillow over my head because it was right there in front of me, and they were not quiet.
You know, and I'm certainly not defending it either. I'm just saying that Doc and Juliet lived the life that they wanted to live, and they felt very good about it.
So he was this study in contrast, as you've said. He's got this freewheeling spirit and anti-establishment philosophy. And yet, as you portray in the documentary, he's pretty authoritarian with his family.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was very domineering. I mean, that's my point. It's not like, hey, let's go surfing because it's cool. It's no, let's surf because surfing is life. And this is our life. And it's a really, for him, it was, I don't want to say serious, but it was very real.
It was a calling.
It was a calling, and the kids, they did have to surf, and they had to be good, and they had to surf a lot. But nobody had as amazing and as vital of a life as anyone I've ever met. There's nobody I know who had a life as amazing as his.
And I understand he's going to be memorialized.
Yeah, I just spoke to Moses Paskowitz, and he said that there are three different events that they're thinking of doing, and they represent the different parts of his life. Surfing was the most important thing in his life, and on December 13th in San Clemente, there's going to be a paddle out that they'll be doing to honor him, celebrate his life. The second most important thing to him was being a Jew, and there's going to be a celebration in Tel Aviv in January, I believe, where he was the first person to ever introduce surfing to Israel.
Really?
Which is kind of interesting. And he really started that back when he brought the first surfboard there. And people were like, what is that guy doing standing on a piece of wood? And then the third part of his life that's the most important to him is just being a doctor. And so I believe there will be another paddle out or some kind of event. This will all be posted on their website, which is AlohaDoc.com.
AlohaDoc.com. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Doug Pray, director of Surfwise, the 2007 documentary about the adventures of the surfing Paskowitz family. We were remembering Doc Paskowitz, who died last week. He was 93 years old.
Don't you find a certain gracefulness in animals in the wild? Certain gracefulness in the jaguar, the certain gracefulness in the bird soaring. A certain gracefulness in a gazelle that leaps. I tell you, every wild animal has it. It's just something we've lost. It's not something we can't have.
Does Doc Paskowitz's life, living in a camper with 9 kids and surfing every day, sound like a dream or a nightmare to you? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, hacking, cooking, the Sporkful's Dan Pashman is here to talk about his new cookbook/textbook, which tells us how to make food more delicious from toast to turkey, after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. This Thanksgiving, as you dig into your huge holiday meal, I want you to remember something. You're probably eating it wrong. The way you indulge in your turkey, that's wrong. The stuffing on the end of your fork, wrong. Mashed potatoes, whipped potatoes, sweet potatoes, wrong, wrong, wrong. At least that's the impression I get from Dan Pashman's new book. It's called Eat More Better, and it's a guide to eat more better.
How to make every bite more delicious.
Well, that's an admirable goal.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm with you 100%. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Madeline. I'm so excited to be here with you in person.
I know. It's after all these years.
I know. It's like our 500th appearance together. On the 500th, you do it in person. That's the custom.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about the big momentous meal of the year,
yeah.
Thanksgiving. How are we doing it wrong?
Well, the first thing I should say is I don't want people to come away from this book feeling bad or feeling that they're doing it wrong as much as I want them to feel like there is an opportunity for them to open up this new world of possibility, of deliciousness. It's not, you know, we all rush through a meal here and there, but really the idea of the book is like, if you just think a little bit more than you do now about each bite, you can make it so much more delicious. And so in the case of Thanksgiving, you know, the first thing you got to think about is like, a bite is a precious resource.
Because you can only have so many bites.
That's right. That's
right. So don't waste them.
Don't waste them. And take note as well, hosts who are hosting on entertaining on Thanksgiving, don't put out cashews on the table before Thanksgiving. Like, you just work for 3 straight days to prepare this meal. You're going to get people to filled up on cashews?
Yeah, no.
And in terms of composing a bite on the fork, I mean, there's just so much to say here. But think a lot about the order in which you fork ingredients at Thanksgiving dinner or any old day if you're eating a salad. Because I call this the proximity effect. Whatever parts of a bite end up in closest proximity to your tongue, those flavors will be accentuated. So when you have a few different foods on a fork, whatever's on the tip of the fork is going to land right on your tongue.
Wow. So you really have to plan out the food placement on the fork?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people are distracted by conversation or whatever, what have you.
Well, look, talking to other people is a classic mistake of eating.
Right, because your mouth can only do one thing at a time.
Well, but also your focus, you know? I mean, I do think that especially when we're talking about a holiday or a special meal, you know, like to me, if it gets quiet when the food is served, that's not a bad thing, okay? It's okay
to... It's not an awkward silence?
No, it's not awkward. It just means that you're having a little you time, you know, and that's okay.
It's a social event, let's remember.
Yeah, but usually, you know, people are there well before the meal is served. They're there well afterwards. It's not like Thanksgiving dinner is 15 minutes. So for the few minutes that you're really sitting down with the food, sit down with the food and just take a few bites that you really focus on. And
now, are you a eat one item and then another item, or do you mash them all together, like a bite of turkey with the mashed potatoes and the gravy all on one?
I like them together, but I don't, I mean, somewhere in between, really. I combine flavors, but not willy-nilly, and I don't feel the need to get everything in the one bite just to say that I did it. I like to combine things. Sometimes I want a little gravy in a bite. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I want some cranberry sauce to add some sweet tart in there. Sometimes I don't. So that's why I like to keep things separate on the plate so you can combine and mix and match on a per-bite basis as you like.
Okay. You have tips for cooking the turkey,
mm-hmm.
which we won't get into because everyone has their own method.
That's true. But I mean,
but
I can
you kind of want to get into
I
it.
I can give you a couple really quick tips, okay. which is number one, the single most important thing no matter how you cook your turkey is to monitor the temperature of the turkey using a good meat thermometer and take the turkey out, I would say, at 160 degrees and let it sit out for at least 30 minutes and continue to cook. Do not ever wait for that plastic needle to pop up.
Oh, yeah, that's the worst.
Right.
Because it'll be overcooked, right?
Right. Those things were designed by lawyers who don't want to get sued because you undercooked your turkey.
Okay, well, that brings us to this point, and that is a lot of people are saying you shouldn't stuff the turkey with stuffing because it'll be undercooked and you could get salmonella.
Yeah, I totally disagree with this. A couple of things. First, I don't think there's any real replacement for the decadence of stuffing that has been sitting inside a turkey for hours, soaking up turkey juices. You need that stuffing inside the turkey for that flavor and the flavor it imparts to the stuffing. There are a couple of drawbacks. One is that you won't end up with enough stuffing. So you do need to cook extra stuffing on the side and then mix it with the stuffing from inside the bird. It is true that it will take longer for your turkey to cook, but to me, that doesn't bother me. I pour myself a drink. I'm in it for the long haul.
Yeah,
I like the momentousness.
You can have your conversation.
Right. What's the rush?
Be done with that part.
Right. It's a holiday. So it really shouldn't be a concern with your turkey if you are monitoring the temperature of the turkey. It could be a concern with the stuffing. But all you need to do after you mix that turkey stuffing with the side stuffing is while the turkey's cooling on your sideboard, put that mixed stuffing back in the oven.
Okay.
Cook it for another 15 or 20 minutes till it's really hot and you'll be fine.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Dan Pashman, author of the new book, Eat More Better. He'll be at the Santa Monica Barnes & Noble tonight at 7 o'clock. Really, your goal in life is, or with this book, is to make every bite more delicious, as the book says.
That's right.
And also to point out that very simple foods we may think that we have nailed, we're maybe not doing cooking in the best way possible. Toast, for example.
Really great toast is not one consistency throughout. It's not just crunchy. It's not a crunch delivery system. There should be interior strata of bread that are softer, like wisps.
Mm. Like almost steamed.
Yes, with a very faint crisp is the way I like it. Now, we can allow for some variation based on taste, but people who say they like their toast well done, I would say if that's how you like your toast, you don't actually like toast, you like crackers. So eat those, which is fine, but then just don't eat toast.
You like a golden toast, not a dark brown toast.
I do, but if people like it a little more or a little less, that's fine. All I'm saying is that if you don't like it to have any textural variation between the outside and the inside, then why are you having toast at all? Why not have a cracker?
Well, some people like a warm, crunchy piece of bread.
Then throw your crackers in the oven. What am I going to tell you?
I also like that you have this idea, which I'd never thought of before, is to butter both sides.
Right.
Because then your tongue can taste the butter.
Right. Well, that's the proximity effect we discussed earlier. Butter goes right on your tongue. You can taste it. Now, some people say, then why not just do butter side down instead of butter side up, which is an option. I'm a little concerned about that, partly because putting the dry side up could result in cutting on the roof of your mouth, which is a condition I've identified as Captain Crunch's complaint. It's a serious medical condition.
I've had that.
Yeah. No, it will.
It's serious business.
Yeah, no kidding.
One of the rules that you seem pretty strict about is grilling hot dogs.
Yeah, this is an area. I mean, I don't think they're as good grilled. What do you think?
I do. I like grilled hot dogs.
Why?
I do. Because I like that charred skin on the outside, and then it counteracts with the kind of soft, steamier, meaty skin.
So is it the textural contrast that you like, or it's
I like also the smoky taste.
Right, okay. I mean,
I feel like I'm saying the wrong thing.
No. I think that when you put a hot dog on the grill, it kind of dries it out a little bit. I think it ends up drier and not as juicy. You know, hot dogs have a whole lot of fat in them, so they're not going to be dry, but the outside to me is dry. If you want that textural experience and the contrast between the outside and the inside, mm-hmm. I recommend go to a good butcher shop and get a hot dog with a natural casing, mm-hmm. which to me is a special kind of pop that you can only get with a sausage with a natural casing.
And then you grill it?
I would boil it or steam it. To me, that maintains maximum juiciness. And hot dogs are already cooked. So if you want to throw it on your grill at high heat for a very short time to get a little char and a little crisp, okay, fine. But I do object to people who just like throw 20 hot dogs in the grill and they let them sit there for 15 minutes. You know, they're drying out and they didn't have to dry out like that. It could have been, there's a better way.
Okay, one of the advantages for you coming in today was that you got to sample our culinary delights here at Santa Monica College.
Yeah.
You went up to the cafeteria, the student cafeteria, and had lunch.
I did. Yeah, it's funny because you warned me, Madeline, before I went up there. And
it's not fine dining.
It's not. And I'm not, my book and my podcast are not about fine dining. And in fact, I kind of love a challenge like this. I will admit that it's slim pickings up there. The Asian station in particular, I weep for the people of Asia when I see the Asian station. That being said, I took up your challenge mm-hmm. to try to create something delicious, given what I was given there. And I looked, just as with any buffet, and I talk about buffet strategy in the book, you want to survey all the options.
Mm-hmm. This is a salad bar you're talking about?
Well, I surveyed all the options because there's the Asian station, right, the burrito station, the entree, and the salad bar.
Which is in the middle, which is kind of like the crown jewel of each street.
That's right. So I surveyed all the options, and the first thing that gave me some inspiration was the orange wedges. You get little tangerine wedges, probably from a can, but still. And I've been on an orange wedge in salad kick lately. Mm-hmm. I love the juicy burst that you get in your mouth. I love the contrast of the sweetness and juiciness of the orange with dry greens and with the bitterness of vinegar.
Mm-hmm. And it's seasonal.
Right. And so that was the first thing that I saw. And then I saw cauliflower, roasted cauliflower, which I always like, and beets, which are nice and sweet. So I had, sweet, the beets and the orange. I had the cauliflower. I put it over some greens. And then one of the best things they have going at East Street is that they just leave a bottle of sriracha on the counter.
Yeah.
So I basically made my own dressing by mixing sriracha and olive oil. It's almost like a sriracha vinaigrette. So, because there's vinegar and sriracha.
Spicy and also,
spicy, a little bit bitter. Mm-hmm. You got the olive oil, you got the sriracha, it's got some kick, some
that
sweet.
It's delicious.
Go ahead. You want to stick your fork in here? Let's give it a shot.
All right, I'll open it here.
Take into account the order in which you fork the ingredients.
Oh, that's right. I was about to forget because I was so busy talking.
See? Classic
Stop
mistake.
Talking. That's right. Okay. Paralyzed with fear that I'm going to make the wrong decision.
You need cauliflower, beets, and oranges.
All in one.
All in one.
It's a lot.
And make sure you get a little sriracha.
Okay.
Make sure there's some sriracha touching it.
All right. I got that. There. How's that?
That looks good. Go for it.
Okay. Mmm. Not bad. There's a little bit of a kick to it, though.
Yeah, well, maybe you got too much sriracha.
Mm, yeah, not a normal salad. I mean, I like it. It's exciting.
Right.
It forces me to pay attention to what I'm eating. Well, I have a newfound respect for Eat Street. Thank you. So the point being that you can make lemonade out of putative lemons.
That's right.
When you go to the salad bar.
And in a million different situations in life, that eating is fun. It's about pleasure. It should be fun, and it should be sort of an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't want people to come away from this, as I said, feeling pressure or feeling inadequacy. I want you to come away feeling like there's so much fun I could have. I'm just going to go out there and experiment. And as long as you're trying to always make things more delicious, then you're winning.
Well, Dan, thank you. That has been so much fun and educational.
Thanks, Madeline.
But in a good, fun way, not in a...
Right. Deliciously educational.
Exactly. The book is Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious by Dan Pashman. And you can meet Dan tonight. He'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Santa Monica at 7 o'clock. Warren Olney, are you an Eat Street aficionado?
Of course I am, and I'm ready for lunch. But
now you know what you can have.
I have a program that I have to do before before I get that, and it's a very interesting subject, namely America's nuclear arsenal, which has fallen into terrible disrepair at a time when, of course, it's thought that it's really not all that necessary anymore, although there are people who still think it is. So we're going to have a very interesting conversation, I think, about whether it's worth $1 trillion over the next 30 years to modernize the so-called triad, submarines, airplanes, and missile silos out in three states where senators have managed to keep them full of missiles.
Interesting. 1 o'clock for that discussion, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you very much.
All right.
And coming up on this program, no more set vacation or sick days at the LA Times. Will that promote more freedom or more work? That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The owners of the Los Angeles Times announced a new vacation policy this week. Starting January 1st, employees at the paper will get unlimited days off. So instead of accruing vacation time, they'll just ask for it whenever they want. It's a policy borrowed from tech companies like Netflix, Groupon, and Zynga, and it seems to be catching on. Last month, Virgin Group founder Richard Branson announced he would offer his employees the same deal. But does unlimited vacation really mean unlimited vacation, or does it just create anxiety so that no one ever asks for time off because they don't feel they've earned it? Well, let's talk about that now with Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He writes about economics and labor markets, among other things. Welcome.
Good to be here.
So how do these policies work? Do employees actually get paid for that time off?
There are two ways, as I see it, to think about unlimited vacation. The first way to think about it is that it's unlimited. And so it seems like an incredible perk for a new job where you say, oh my God, I can take 2 weeks, 2 months, half a year off, and I can't actually be punished. It's something that's given to you. But in practice, there is evidence that these unlimited vacation policies, in fact, are not good for maximizing vacation because employees feel like rather than being given a specific number of days, 10 or 15, let's say, where you can tell yourself, all right, I've taken 5 days off, there's 15 total days, that means I've already been given, I've been promised 10 additional days. Now, there is no number, there's no anchoring. And so people feel like they have to ask for it. They feel like they have to earn every vacation day. And so what there is some empirical evidence that has shown that companies in general that have offered unlimited vacation ironically see workers taking less vacation time.
Right. And here in the United States, workers notoriously don't take the vacation time that they actually have as is. So this
very
would,
notoriously.
Yeah. So this would mean even less time off?
Right. 41% of us don't take all of our vacation already. It creates a total of 169 million work days that we leave on the table that we could otherwise take off. Americans are work martyrs. We're not like the Europeans, where there is a historical and cultural acceptance of taking a lot of time off, say, during the summer. In the U.S., not only do we work more hours, but over time, we are taking fewer vacation days. In 2000, we took 20 days on average, about 3 weeks. In 2013, last year, research showed we took only 16 days. So the amount of vacation has already in one decade declined by half a week. Americans have a culture of arduousness, of showing that we have status by telling people that we're busy. And we don't have the same cultural acceptance, I think, of taking lots of time off. And so the irony of offering unlimited vacation, which does appear year if you haven't yet joined a company to be a wonderful perk, in practice ends up becoming this feeling where you have to constantly beg yourself and implicitly your employer to give you those days off.
Well, yeah. And in fact, I think the LA Times memo says that one of the challenges for supervisors will be to enforce this time off, to actually get people to take their vacation, because they think that, or they're saying at least in this memo, that a well-rested employee is a more productive employee.
Right. I mean, I think that even though it sounds wonderful to offer people the freedom to set their own vacation policy, the research shows that the less freedom we have, the more we're likely to get all of our vacation. You have use it or lose it policies at some companies where they essentially say, if you don't use all 15 days, you can't roll it over. So you use it now or you lose it. Some people will even offer to pay their employees to take vacation, which is an awfully interesting way of sort of managing long-term productivity. But it has been shown again and again that burnout is not just a wishy-washy thing. It is a real thing. You can only push yourself so far. And taking a little bit of time off does have this remarkable ability to wipe our brains clean and help us re-arrive at old problems with more creative solutions. And so it is good, not only for the individual and his or her family, but also for the company at large, for people to think more strategically and more empirically about how to get their employees to actually take vacation, not how to give their employees the sense that unlimited vacation means 2 months off of work.
So why don't they just increase the amount of allotted vacation then? Wouldn't that do the thing that they purport to want, which is for employees to take more time off to be more productive? So why not just give them that more time off instead of this more nebulous policy?
I'm sorry that I can't answer the question because you're preaching to the choir here. I think that what companies should do is precisely that. They should say we have a certain number of days, let's say 14, 20, 25, that we think that all of our employees should take off. You're going to use these days. You're going to use them. We're going to find some way to punish you, perhaps, if you don't use them, or perhaps incentivize you with extra money to use lots of them, to use like more than 80% of them. You want to create a culture, I think, that says when you're here, you should be working hard. But we understand that being here and working hard for 16 hours a day over and over without vacation for a year and a half is not a good way to demonstrate or to basically maximize long-term creative thinking. And it's just ironic that a lot of the companies that are now offering unlimited vacation are precisely the kind of companies that would benefit by having these stricter vacation policies that said, you have to leave. We're a creative company. We need you to have creative solutions to problems. And if we overwork you, even if it's just you feeling like you owe it to the company to work week after week without taking any time off, we're all going to be worse off. So we're going to find some way, frankly, to punish you if you don't do the thing that's better for all of us, which is take some vacation.
So what is the real motivation then for these kinds of open-ended vacation sick policies? Is it to make sure that they don't take vacation? And is it to, at least in the LA Times case, they're not allowed to roll over their accrued vacation anymore? So because they won't have any accrued vacation to roll over in the first place.
I think it's a few things. I think, number one, it's possible that these companies just aren't thinking all that empirically. They don't see the evidence that says that these unlimited vacation policies actually result in less vacation. Or if they have seen the evidence and they think, oh, well, that actually works out just fine for us because we don't want our employees taking that much time off. But the other thing is that I think that, you know, companies can sometimes miswant on the part of their employees. They can think that the good thing for everybody is freedom of choice when it comes to vacation time, or they can think that it's working their employees really hard for a long period of time and not realize that what's really good for creative thinking, according to just lots and lots of this social science, is taking breaks during days and taking time off of work so that you can basically clear the RAM in your head and reapproach old problems with new solutions that sometimes require a little bit of a clean slate. So I don't think necessarily that it's the case that these companies are being nefarious. I think that they're doing their best to find a program or come up with a program that's going to attract talent without actually realizing that the best talent, the best work, is often done not when we're at our wit's end, but when we're just coming off from a little bit of rest and relaxation.
Well, you work at The Atlantic. It has an unlimited vacation policy. And what's your personal experience been with that?
It's interesting. So when we started this unlimited vacation policy, I thought it was a fabulous idea. It was one of my colleagues who initially brought up the point that whereas before we had, say, 10 or 15, I don't remember how many days off, and we could always say we're anchored at 15. If it's November and I've only taken five, I deserve that last 10 because it's right there in my contract. And now we have to basically beg for that extra 10, or we have to ask our employers if we can take it. And then that led me to look at the research and to see whether these unlimited vacation policies actually did result in more vacation, and it turned out that they did not. That the irony was that unlimited vacation policy was a road to fewer vacation days.
So how many days have you taken off this year?
Oh God! What a good question. I'd say I think about seven or eight.
Okay. I think that says it all right there.
it's one of these things where the nice thing about hypocrisy is that it allows you to say the right thing even as you're doing the wrong thing. So I can report that the empirical research says that I should be taking more time off, but I'm just as bad as the people that I'm castigating right now on this show by being a workaholic and probably not taking off nearly as much time as I should.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hard at work as always, Julie Myers. Hello.
Hi. Derek Thompson and Dan Pashman, same person, right? They sound exactly alike. I think one of them is taking vacation to work at The Atlantic. Okay, so we wanted to know what you all thought of this time off policy. Leslie Nilau weighed in on Facebook. She said that her company has this same kind of policy and it works just fine. But she works for a much smaller company than Tribune and her bosses really encourage her to take the time off. But Brittany Burke says that she doesn't like the sound of it. She says that this whole if you need time off, ask kind of thing makes it awkward for employees to ask for time off. Employees who ask for and take time off could be targeted for having less of a work ethic than the people who never take any time off at all. And David Brown says that corporate America has already managed to snuff out retirement plans for workers moving from pensions to 401ks. It looks like sick leave and vacation time are next on the chopping block. Are we rolling everything back to the 1890s?
All right. If you want to weigh in on this, we welcome your comments. Our Facebook page is KCRW Press Play. Our Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand. I think it's lunchtime for you and me, Julie Myers. But stay tuned for Warren Olney and To the Point coming up at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brandon. I'll see you tomorrow.